Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's all my childhood figures.
You're kidding. Yeah. They're here now.
They're all there.
What three wrestling matches would you watch if you were stranded on a desert island? This is what I'm asking wrestling's best. In the ring, around the ring, behind the scenes, or behind a microphone. I'm Tom Campbell. Thank you for joining me on Cultaholic Island for another episode of Desert Island Graps.
Joined again on Cultaholic Island by a resident of Cultaholic Island. Look at this.
Yeah.
Sound driver.
How are you doing, mate? How are you doing?
This is an odd. This is the one I think I've been most intrigued to do.
Why?
Genuinely. Because I feel like I started here back in July. Right. July. And I don't feel
sorry,
like.
Sorry, I'm being rude.
No, by all means, you drink whatever
I'll
you need.
Sip
to.
I don't want you all hearing, like.
Please do.
A bit of ASMR.
We can add that. But no, I feel like that. Out of everybody here, I don't think you and I have spent as much time together.
I think it's the way that our work sort of falls. So yeah. I'm always either editing or like we'll quickly do a news, but it's like it's always find out at like 9:15 and it's like, hurry. And then it's just in, out, done. And
there's normally you've got like a whole busy schedule.
I don't think
stuff.
We've done a reactions together. I don't think we've done much.
No, like,
just
we haven't.
On camera. So yeah.
So if any, this is an adventure for people to find out more about you and kind of for me.
Yeah.
So, as well.
Yeah, you've got pretty much unrestricted access.
Oh
so
gosh, hello, you pervert. It's quite shocking. The first thing that I learned about you, and I made this mistake very early on. Your name is Sam, but not as we know it.
What do you mean?
Well, your name isn't Samuel.
No, my name isn't Samuel. No, it's Sam. My mum used to get really angry with people that would call me Samuel. I was just christened Sam. I think I was like nearly William. My middle name is William. I think I will have been like William Driver and a numeral. Or at least I could have put a numeral in there, and that would have been cool. But you know,
why the particular anger about Samuel as opposed to Sam?
I have no idea. I think it's just because Sam was my name.
That's fair enough.
It was like he's not called Samuel. It wasn't like she wasn't like you know flipping tables and stuff. It'd always just be like whenever somebody would call me Samuel.
I think I remember the first time. I think I said it quite a flippant way in a video, and you were very quick to go, "It's not Samuel."
It's hard burned into me now.
Yeah, you've taught that. It's just because I think a lot of people take the assumption that long version of the name is
well,
for when you're
in
trouble.
It tends to be, yeah. Whenever somebody says Samuel, it's like they're being all like, "Whoa, I've caught you out." And it's like, no, you haven't.
See,
my name isn't Samuel at all. I have deceived you.
You're clearly not talking to me anymore. the other thing that struck me as soon as you walked in, you're the only one that I've ever sat down with that's prepared.
Yeah, so you told me in advance we were doing this. I wanted to make sure I had some notes on the matches. I have the mind of like an 85-year-old. I really need to start doing some more mentally engaging. I mean, Christ, the way I'm talking right now shows you how my brain is. I need to start doing something more mentally engaging with my time. I think I'm maybe going to take up a language or something just to like give me a bit of like something to jog my head a bit because I do just I'll like forget I'll just unless it's something I've got to do like by a set time and I've got a note I'm just like sort of sat there and then the time will go past and I'm like I'm sure I had to do something and then like Slack will be on fire or office messaging app and I'll be like oh yeah Got to do that.
Has that always been a case where you've not had a great memory?
No, I think it's just with more sort of as my work has just progressed. And the nature of the work is just fast. And I'm like a sort of like a dog chasing cars sometimes. If I find something really cool or if I learn how to do something new and if I've got some really pressing project on and I know it has to be done by the end of the day, I might still just sit and mess around with it for a couple of hours through the day and then just stay a couple of hours after work because I'm having such a fun time learning something. So I get sidetracked real easy. But it's not like a problem. It's just that, yeah, I'm quite forgetful.
It's a sign of a creative, though.
It's more like just get your stuff together, Sam. Come on.
Like, but it's also like that creative side in the sense that, like you say, you like to play around with it and make it right.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's sort of like I will sometimes, the mood will just take me. I'll be sat at home. So, well, this is the other thing as well. Sometimes you're sitting at home and it's like, I should be working. It's like, no, you shouldn't. But I like, if I've got something I want to learn how to do, or if I'm sat watching a YouTube tutorial or like a video Copilot tutorial on like this new editing technique or this new like plugin, and I'm like, I've got to try it. And so I'll get a trial and then I'll just sit for hours. And before I know it, it's 2 a.m. And then I'm like sort of 5 or so minutes late to work the next morning, knackered. You'll go, we need to do news. And I'll literally be like, oh. So I apologize for instances
now,
where
there
that's
are, there are some
this
days.
I'm just like, I can't even breathe.
I get it. There are some days when something will happen and it'll be me and you doing news. And I'm very aware that at a certain time in the morning.
I think I told you after the first time it happened, I was like, I'm really sorry. Sometimes I just, if I don't have coffee in 5 minutes, I can't. And it sounds, that's so diva-y.
No, you're not at all.
It's like sort of, I don't know what it is. I think I was just waking up later and later and I've just sort of got a bit complacent. I've started waking up at about 7-ish. Mm. Like, and even then that's not too early. But like, I've started waking up about 7, which gives me a good like hour and a half before I have to leave the flat now, which is good because it means I can get up, just slowly wake up, and then I get into work and I feel alive, not like, oh.
I feel like we're quite polarizing people on a morning.
Yeah, you want you it's been your job to be to be engaging at early hours. One thing is, like, I used to be a paper boy like way, way back in the day, and I used to love getting up early. I get up early every single day, and just sort of like, I've come from the mentality of like, you don't want to waste a day. So if you're going to sit and like lounge around all day, either enjoy that to the fullest, otherwise, you know, it's sort of just a waste. So
I want to talk more about like downtime and other things away from wrestling in a little while, but the reason you're here today, Sam, is we're sending you on a desert island,
right?
And we're going to burn onto a DVD for you because we're in the past.
DVD?
A digital versatile disc.
Can we not get a Blu-ray? Or a laser disc?
I might give you a HD DVD. The one that Microsoft got behind that failed.
Well, you know why HD DVD failed?
Porn industry.
Yes, porn industry has dictated, it's like a random fact about porn. Porn industry has dictated physical media all the way through. So VHS versus Betamax. Betamax is more expensive. But they still use Betamax like in TV production now because it's capable of holding.
Do they really?
Yeah.
I never knew that.
It's capable of holding like really, really high res stuff on it. I can't remember the exact reason, but yeah, Betamax is still in use today in some circles. But that was more expensive. DVD was cheaper than Laserdisc. And plus Laserdisc was like this. Nobody's going to buy porn on a disc that big. And then, you had Blu-ray versus HD DVD. Blu-ray was cheaper. So that was it.
I was working at HMV when the Blu-ray HD DVD wars were starting.
I very nearly bought the Xbox 360 add-on. And I was so happy that I didn't because it was like 6 months. There was about 12 HD DVDs to the point where now I think it's become like a collector's thing. Like people try and collect them all because, you know, it's what you do. But yeah, I was so happy I didn't get one.
Well, I'll tell you what, just for you, we're going to give you a Betamax player.
Okay.
See if that were a Ferguson Video Star.
Right.
So
and does it come with an actual remote, or is it one of those horrible Betamax remotes where there's a cable?
Oh, it's on a wire.
Yes. Yeah, so
of course it's on a wire.
I have to get up to be within a foot of the TV anyway.
Absolutely.
But I'm a foot away from the TV, so that's fine. I'll use the remote.
So with this Betamax player and a controller on a wire, we're going to put 3 wrestling matches on for you to watch whilst you're on the island.
Okay.
So what's your first wrestling match going to be?
So wrestling Wrestling to me is something that sort of I was very, very young when I got into it, as are most of us. And the most vivid memories I have, I think the first memory I have of wrestling is it was like a weekend. I was around at my auntie's house and her son was watching, like my cousin, he was watching. It was some WWF show, but I just remember the flash of colors. I remember the old school ring. I remember Doink. I like the colors of Doink. And then after that, I sort of didn't really know much about wrestling. I know, like, my mum was a huge fan of The Undertaker. My dad, I think, dipped in and out. But it would be Friday nights when my mum would work late. My dad would be watching me because, like, he'd finish at normal time. And about 9 o'clock, like, I wouldn't have to go to bed because it was Friday night. So me and my dad would stay up and it was, like, cool secret, stay up and watch some stuff. It was like 9 o'clock. It was on, do you remember satellite dish? Like satellite provider before, I think cable was around at the same time, but a lot more homes had satellite. We didn't have Sky, but we had like this package that enabled us to get Cartoon Network. And then at 9 o'clock, Cartoon Network changed over to TNT.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That Friday, it, like every Friday, I think it was a repeat from the Monday's Nitro at 9 o'clock. So first thing would happen, it would switch over to static and then it would just go straight into the Nitro intro. That would be it. So like vivid memories of that. And so I think like a lot of my selections are going to be based around, because you know, I'm stuck on an island forever and I'm alone, because I'm assuming I'm alone. You're going to want to be able to sort of reminisce and remember people and stuff. So I could just fill the island with, you know, the Betamax with work rate classics, but it's not worth anything if I don't have some sort of connection to it. So for my first pick, I'm going for a very controversial match. Hollywood Hogan versus Goldberg, the World Championship match from WCW Monday Nitro, 6th of July, 1998.
With this, with what you say about your memories of watching WCW in the UK,
yeah.
My favourite statistic about this time in wrestling
yeah.
is that with regards to the UK, WCW won the Monday Night War.
Yeah.
Because more people had access to WCW worldwide than anything else.
What channel was it on?
Channel 5.
Channel 5, yeah. So, I mean, but even then, that's coming along late. Channel 5 was, what, 98, 99?
Yeah, it was.
So, yeah, and even then, not everybody could get it because it was only broadcast over certain bands. But I remember worldwide, briefly, I remember the comic book Microsoft Paint, like, pow and ouch and stuff that would turn up over chair shots.
Yes, that was yeah. it.
And they would have, like, it would be boing and, like, just weird sound effects, which just completely ruined the seriousness. But it was, I guess, the only way they could get it on at, like, 9 a.m. weekends for kids.
The other thing to do was what WWF did at that time. Every time there was a chair shot, cut to a random shot of the crowd.
Well, the thing I preferred that I wish they still did, rather than cut to the crowd, is just do the freeze frame.
Freeze frame,
because
yeah.
the freeze frame, you heard the impact, you saw the chair get close to the head, it would freeze and then it would just continue after the impact. It would just cut back to them like on the floor and like the heel sort of going mad for it. But like I always thought that was a much better way to handle it than cutting to the crowd, because there is nothing worse than cutting to the crowd, especially because it's always that moment of like the fan just sort of not knowing they're on camera and going like,
yeah, they always look gormless.
And then they see themselves and then they go, and then just as they're getting excited, they cut away. It's like, you couldn't have a camera guy going like, come on, get mad for it. But yeah.
That was it. Why Hogan Goldberg?
Well, it's sort of, I remember the NWO and it was the biggest, coolest thing in the world. And I think I was, there were only a couple of kids in my primary school who watched WCW. Everybody else was WWF. And they were missing out on NWO. And NWO was like, for me, just the craziest thing. Like, just absolutely the craziest thing. And, like, heel Hogan, it was just perfection. It was, like, at the time as a kid, it was just so, so good. And then, obviously, you know, like, you had the Monday Night Wars, which spawned off everything, and it all went back and forth. But I think this was WCW's last hurrah, basically. And it was, you know, as a WCW kid, this is a massively like important moment, I guess. It's up there with, for me, the final Nitro, because this is the last time WCW would beat WWF in the ratings, I believe. And simply because they put a pay-per-view quality match on free TV. The match itself is pretty standard. It's pretty, you know, your 19-minute Goldberg entrance, Hogan coming down. There's a bit of interference from some NWO people, which is a bit crap. But the back and forth, it's just proper Golden Age 80s style heel versus face, super simple, nothing over the top. Hogan gets to a point where, like, Goldberg's distracted. He hits him with three leg drops, and the crowd's like, no, 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 no. And then he kicks out. The place goes wild. Finally hits the spear. Like, it's just everything in the match. Like, the crowd's so hot for it. Everything was just perfect. It was like, for me, it captures perfectly what WCW was at the time and what it sort of meant as a company. And this is Goldberg, I think, like, a year into his run. So there was obviously all of the, is the streak going to end? Like, all of that stuff. And it would obviously end horribly, but for this night, it was great.
It felt like a star was born that night.
Oh, he was very much born beforehand, but it was... Yeah, this was sort of like solidifying him. But not everybody was happy. There was garbage being thrown in the ring. But, you know, pushed to the moon. Goldberg was like my favorite as a kid because he'd just come in and just level people.
That was the appeal, wasn't it? There was nothing OTT about his matches. Just come in, batter somebody and leave.
Watching him beat the absolute piss out of Disco Inferno like every week was just, it was great. It was absolutely great.
I seem to remember in that match the point you mentioned with Hogan dropping three legs.
Yeah.
And also, remember, as that was happening, you had...
Kurt Hennig walks to the ring.
Kurt Hennig. Karl Malone was out there, the mailman. Was it Karl Malone hitting a diamond cutter?
Yes.
On Hennig?
On Hennig.
Outside the ring.
Yeah.
As that pivotal moment of, like, Goldberg kicking out.
You hear the leg go, like, the final leg drop. You hear that as Hennig's like three quarters of the way down the ramp. Then it keeps cutting back and forward. And then, yeah, he hits the diamond cutter and you miss the first, I think, one. And then, like, nearly, I think you catch from two and you just get the kick out. And it's like...
you want to shake somebody a little bit.
It's,
like a...
it's NWO. It's WCW. It's got to happen. You've got to have 90 million interferences. Otherwise, what's the point?
Were you watching that one with your dad?
I probably will have done, yeah. It's sort of just, we just, every Friday, we just sort of roll over.
Friday night was wrestling night.
Yeah, basically.
When you watch stuff like that, and we talk quite a bit, we've talked quite a bit already about sort of production elements of a wrestling show and putting that together. It's very much your forte.
I wouldn't say it's my forte, but I worked with WCPW. Obviously, I was the live show director, for lack of a better word. I didn't really have a hand in much of the booking. I'd be privy to some meetings. I'd be told about some stuff in advance if we needed assets making. But from the start, I was originally a camera guy at ringside, shot it horribly, learned the hard way how to shoot wrestling. There is a specific way that you shoot wrestling. There is like a specific way certain things are handled. I did everything wrong. And you just sort of, it gets like reintroduced to you properly. So like we shot from all these awful angles. We had Mark and some of the guys from down south come in and they were like, no, this is how you do that. And then we had running orders, which I mean, we didn't originally have running orders. So it was nice to have running orders. But then I met Jim Cornette and he was like, no, these are all wrong. You need to do this, 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 and this. And I was like, cool. And then like we had Delirious from Ring of Honor. He was like, no, you need to do this and this. He's like, I can see like you're doing this with all of your schedules. You need to change this up. And you just sort of piece by piece put the puzzle together, I guess. But yeah, it's...
What do you mean by you filmed it wrong?
So when you... There's something in drama, in film theory. It's called the line of action. So like, if you notice in a scene, if somebody's on the right, they'll always be on the right. There's like a line and you're allowed to go 180 degrees and shoot from that angle. So that camera there, like the line of action between us is like parallel. So like it can go around, but you'll always stay on the left. I'll always stay on the right. So the way you do it is you have your hard cam shooting and then you have a secondary hard cam. So the hard cam's just locked off. You have a secondary hard cam, which is roving, which, you know, you can get your slightly closer WWE style wide shot. And then you have, for smaller wrestling anyway, WWE doesn't adhere to this because they've got 90 million cameramen, but most of the time it does work that way. You have, so say you have your hard cam here, ring here, so hard cam's pointing that way. Your two cameras go like on these two corners nearest the hard cam, and then you shoot, you're all shooting toward the same way. And at that point, it makes it so much easier for the eye to digest. And especially if you're not going ham on cuts. Sometimes you have to break those rules 100% because, you know, sometimes things spill out the ring. But like 90% of the time, you've got to sort of adhere to that line of action. And it makes it so much easier to understand.
When you were learning stuff like that, was there something, as a film buff that you are, was there something that you learned that blew your mind?
Not particularly. Like I was more surprised that we'd have to adhere to line of action for sports, for like a sports style production. It was mainly just little things where I was like, this has been applied here. Okay, I understand that. Like the thing that I sort of learned that blew me like completely away was just how subject to change wrestling is, like how nuts it can go, how everything sort of, no matter how well planned it is, it all goes out the window. Like there's just, things just change on a penny. Like the amount of times I'd have notes coming to me going, oh, we're moving this, we're scratching that, we're getting rid of this. And then I'd have to tell Adam, who would then relay that to commentary. And it's like, okay, we're not going to that VT anymore. We need to buy time. We're going to come to you. You guys need to talk and then introduce it. And then while they're talking, they've got Adam in the ear going like, championship match next month, this pay-per-view, this is what we're doing. So they're having to listen to him and talk while doing all of this, while I'm like, stall, stall, stall. And at the same time, I'm cutting all the cameras. I'm dealing with the with Simon, who was running like the production, like the live screens and everything. He was feeding stuff to me, and then I'd feed stuff to sound, and then sound would feed stuff. So it's a big collaborative experience. And when it goes right, it's fine. Like, it's absolutely fine. But, like, you know, you don't expect a pat on the back. It's your job. But when it goes wrong, whoa.
There's,
it's, you know, the public lets you hear it.
There was a, excuse me, there was a WCPW retrospective.
Yes.
That you all sat down and did. And on there, you do recount the story of the night the line failed, essentially. And we won't go into that now. I think that's nice for people to find for themselves. How did it come, though, for you to go from operating a camera to being basically the Kevin Dunn of the operation, almost?
It was sort of like, initially it was like, we're starting a promotion. It was like, what? Like, okay. And then it was like, we're going to run a small show. I was like, okay. And then, so I like handled camera. I was one of the camera operators on that. And then it was, okay, well, we were moving to the academy, and it was like, okay. And then I sort of handled cameras again. And then it was, well, we want to do a live pay-per-view. And it's like, okay, well, how do we do a live pay-per-view? And it's like, well, we need to vision mix, we need this, so we had to buy an equipment that would allow that. And then you need at the same time, you need a direct uplink to a satellite, you need like a decent enough connection to be able to do that, you need all these things. And because I'd done a little bit of vision mixing at uni, because I'd used the software and I'd used like telecasting software before, I think it just sort of fell at my feet a bit. And it was something I was really happy to pick up and run, but I didn't for those first, like, because we ran like dry tests, so we were running like tapings in the academy. I would sit at side of stage, and it wouldn't be going out to anybody. We'd just be recording it as a test, and I would just crap myself like the entire time. It was like, well, until you sort of work out the rhythm that everybody works at, until you work out how everybody's entrances go, like, this guy's going to come out and he's going to stand still. This guy's not going to come out until this note, so there's no point cutting to that. What are you going to do in the meantime? You build an understanding and you start to understand the language of the work in the ring. So, you know, he's throwing him here. Okay, go to this camera. And it gets to a point where, because everybody's learning this at the same time, the camera operators, the people doing sound, people doing everything, it's all being learned at the same time. So it's one big learning experience. And then eventually you all speak the same language, and I can just sit there without having to go camera two, camera three, camera one, camera three, camera two. I can just be like, cut, 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 and then give him a quick heads up and be like, oh, we need to come to you for this. But yeah, I think it sort of fell at my feet, and it was, yeah.
It almost becomes muscle memory.
Yeah, it's like, I would love to do it again. I would love just once more, maybe, to vision mix a show if I had enough time to like prep it, because I think I could do a pretty good job still.
Right, your second match
second
for the
match.
Island, sir.
Okay, there's not really a lot to say about this one. Undertaker versus Shawn Michaels, WrestleMania 25.
Ooh.
26 takes the cake in terms of story. It's great, but 25 is a much more athletic affair in my eyes. It's probably the last great Undertaker match, if you include the year after as well. But this is, for me, this is like the last real great Undertaker match is 25.
So in terms of like the quality of the match, you're picking it over 26.
The quality of the actual like contest,
yeah,
back and forth. Because 26 was emotional, but 25 was just sort of like a straight up, I'm going to beat the streak. It's like, okay. And that's like, there wasn't so much going into it. It was just like a straight up contest. And I liked that.
You mentioned at the beginning that your mum was an Undertaker fan.
Yes.
Does that make you an Undertaker fan as well?
Yes, for life. It's just one of those things. Like, it's, I think we grew up in a household where Undertaker and Bret Hart and British Bulldog were like gods. that was it. Like, my mum used to have an Undertaker mug that she would drink out of every day. One of the like old hand painted, like printy WWF ones. You can often see the Hulk Hogan ones because they made so many of those, or the Macho Man ones. But it was just like a straight up white mug with a blue handle and just this like really dated picture, like hand drawn picture of the Undertaker on it. Like, one of the, it must have been like a very early 90s piece of official merch, because it was just like, it was proper weird.
So it was a very wrestling household, as you mentioned earlier on.
I think it was more that my mum was sort of a fan of wrestling. Then I got into it, and it was like, I need toys, I need this, I need that. And then because I got into it, my brother got into it. And so we had rings, we had figures. I mean, Christ, there's a bag of figures out there, which I still need to take home.
Is there?
Yeah, there's a big bag of figures out there.
What?
It's all my childhood figures.
You're kidding. Yeah. They're here now.
They're all there. But it's, so there's that. There's like when my little sister, like when she was sort of growing up in that environment, she sort of watched it a little bit. But I think we very much created more of an obsession with wrestling. It was probably me and my brother than my mom. My mom just likes Undertaker, so she just cares about Undertaker, which was super hard after Mania 33. When I rang her like the next day, and she was like, "Oh, how's it going?" I was like, "Yeah, Mom, I think Undertaker's retired." And she was just like, "What?" I was like, "Yeah, I think he's retired." It was just, yeah, sort of the day he finally retires. It's why I'm such an Undertaker fan. It's why whenever I'm in reactions, I cheer for him. But like, yeah, the day he retires is going to be a dark day. Dark, dark.
How
day.
Do you feel about the Undertaker currently?
Greatest character in professional wrestling, like hands down. Like, there will never be another character like him. We are lucky enough to have somebody even a tenth as good as him in Bray Wyatt and The Fiend, and that's so amazing. That's how good Undertaker is. But like, there is not going to be any more unless The Fiend really, really sets this new trend off of big characters again, which I hope it does, because that's part of what I loved about wrestling was like the more out there characters. I think that trend's dying because indie wrestling has taught everybody that to be a great wrestler, you have to be a good wrestler. And that's it. Like, it's all about, the gimmick is just, I'm really good at wrestling, I'm really tough. It's like, okay, but what sets you aside from the other 10,000 people that are really good at wrestling and really tough? And for me, that's why I sort of lean more on the classic character wrestlers. Like, and when I think of like my all times.
What does your mum reckon to the work you do now?
She's very proud, obviously. I don't think she quite grasps it. Like, she understands YouTube and everything. She understands it's my job. And like, she watches the channel and she watches videos. But I don't think... I got noticed once when I was out with her in town. I think that solidified it a little bit for her, where it was like, oh, like, who was that? And I was like, it's just somebody who watches the channel. And she was like, what? I was like, yeah. Like, I think my dad slightly understands more, because my mum's like, she's not technophobe, but she's got better things to do than sit on YouTube all day. So like my dad is sort of a little bit more like free with technology and stuff, so I think he grasps it just a little bit more. But yeah, she's super proud. She was like, really happy when we broke off on our own. So, yeah.
Before we go on to breaking off on your own,
yes,
the figures are out there, aren't they?
Yes.
I've got to bring them in. Oh, I can't stop thinking about them.
It's the big blue Budweiser bag.
The big blue Budweiser bag. That one.
Yes.
Right. I think we've got to bring them in. This is...
Pass them here.
Come here. Right. Pull out from the bag.
So this is one of my favourites. Was Raven, big Raven fan, but yeah, none of these are going to stand, I don't think, because they just don't stand, do they?
Well, oh, but no, they're always bad at that. So this is,
yeah, I've got a Sting original WCW, is it Toys Biz, whatever the company was called.
Well, I'd like to point out this bit genuinely wasn't part of what we were going to do today.
Yeah.
Like when you dropped that in there, I was like, we have to bring them in.
Yeah,
so it's so funny how you can tell the difference between like WCW figures and WWF figures.
Because they do things like this. Like they've got like kung fu grip and stuff.
And also Sting is like a foot shorter than Raven.
Yeah. But DDP from the same collection is
we had a moment years ago for Christmas where my nan brought for my brother a WCW ring instead of the WWF ring.
Yes. Was it the one with the cushion?
It was the one with the springy.
It's got like a springy like piece of material underneath. There was a thing that would just go like, oh,
yeah,
noises. Yeah,
it was great. But there was hell on.
Super, super collectible. Now. We've got one of those at home. We've got the WWF carry case one somewhere at home, which was like a ring with a handle that unclipped and went inside, so you could store everything inside. And then you'd take the turnbuckles and everything out, you'd put it all together, and then you could sort of just pack it all down again. We've got the Elimination Chamber somewhere as well. It's like,
wow.
I think it was my brother's, but...
Oh, I love that. Yeah. So these are some of your faves. So we've got DDP, these got a bit of Sting.
I'm just pulling these
just
out.
Just pulling out random ones. So were these just at home? Was it a case of your mum saying, look, are you going to do anything with these?
No, it was sort of like, I just brought them in for the sake of just, like, maybe we can use them for something.
Well, we're using them now.
Yeah.
They're now tax deductible.
Random X-Pack.
Hey.
Unposable. That's weird.
Why was it that Sean Waltman, every single Sean Waltman figure always had his tongue sticking out?
Because that's what X-Pack does.
Sid every single one.
With a massive knee. That. Sid has a knee.
it's just as functional as your actual
that's
one.
That's the one. we could go on all day.
We'll leave those ones out just whilst we're continuing this.
Sid's not going to...
Sting, have a sit down, mate. Have a sit down, Sid. He's, bless him. There he goes. Is he going? Have a lie down, mate. Have a lie down.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You talked about the change, the move from where you were before to Cultaholic.
Yes, yeah.
Talk us through, from your experience, the day that all broke. Because I was a fan of what you guys were doing.
Yeah.
And I remember it all coming down the line.
Yeah.
Talk us through it.
Well, it happened a lot earlier than we anticipated. We knew there'd be some reaction. We knew there'd probably be a statement to get out, like in front of what was going to happen. Yeah, it was scary, man. It was super scary because it was like, it was all well and good sitting there, like, giving it big, and, like, you know, after a couple of pints going, we could do this. But when you're staring it down, like, it's like, could we? Like, are we going to do this? Is it going to work?
Was the first meeting about Cultaholic over several beers?
Because
I always picture it being a bit like how you plan. It's like how you plan to go to Ibiza with your mates after several beers. But in this case, it's we're going to run a company.
Yeah, it was more like something that had germinated in all of our minds separately, I think. But we all sort of went, nah, that probably wouldn't work. And then when we realized that we were all sort of on the same page, and we were sort of at a level where we were ready to do it, and we were in a position mentally where it was the only option for us, then it had to be done. So I think it was very much something that would get thrown around almost jokingly over a couple of beers. And then over time, it just sort of started getting more and more serious. And it was like, well, no, actually, if you look at this and if you break this down and if you work that out and if all of these things fall in line, then we have a chance here. And it was very much one of those situations. And it was sort of, it's when you take that first step, it's like, right, well, I'm betting on myself, so you can't let yourself down. And so it's, and as somebody who sort of goes into most things expecting the worst, because if you expect the worst, you can never be disappointed in life. It led to me having to completely change the way I think about things and working. Like, I wouldn't, like, I'd keep everything going, RSS feeds, anything. Like, when, at the time, like, me and Jack lived in the same house with a few other people. We had a set of lights. We had a cheap, crap pop-up green screen. We had, like, all of this stuff. And it was all set up in my room, which was the front room of this big old house. And so there was a couch, and we'd put this green screen up. And at, like, 2 a.m, if something broke, it would be like, either I'd knock on Jack or Jack would knock on me, and he'd be like, let's go. And so it was just round the clock, like, we have to just deliver and deliver and deliver. We had to shoot WTF, like, outside in various locations until we could secure the office and get that all down. And it was a massive undertaking, but just sort of, yeah, it's weird to look back on. It's weird that we're 2 years old now.
Hindsight's 2020, and yeah, we know that, you know, this has been a successful business to date. And was there a point, though, in the first few weeks where you may have thought to yourself, I've made a big mistake here?
No, there's certain things where it's just sort of like, it was very trying, it was very testing. There was a point where I don't think any of us thought it would go on. And, you know, I think we banded together and we had to just look this impossibility in the face and do it. And that was it. So it's sort of, we had to really dig deep for that. But I think there was a point where we all sort of thought, you know, this is it. Like, we're sort of cooked here. That's the end of it.
Because it was a risk to enter a crowded market for this sort of thing. And a market that's even more crowded 2 years on.
And a market that our main competition,
yeah,
we had built. So, or we, not what we had built, that we'd had a hand in building. Mm. So, like it's sort of, yeah, it was, I think we just believed that, like, people liked watching us as a unit. People enjoyed our back and forth. People enjoyed us as personalities. Not so much me, because I wasn't really on camera at the time, but, like, people enjoyed the flow of the stuff that we were doing. So if people liked that, then, you know, they don't have to unsubscribe from anything else. Like, they can watch everything, but they'll hopefully watch us because, you know, they like that stuff. If we can bring that stuff over here, then they'll watch it.
The plan wasn't originally for you to do as much front of camera stuff as you do.
No, there was we had to have a shake up, and there were certain circumstances that led to me being, you know, a personality. And it's something that initially I was a bit like, oh God, like, I'm sort of, I was always the guy behind the camera. That's how I liked it. Like, I hated being on front of camera, hated it at uni, hated it whenever anybody, like, even like dared to try and get me in front of camera, it was like, nah. But I would, you know, slowly do a little bit here and there at the old place, like in some reaction videos. And even then I was sort of like, but this was a whole different kettle of fish because it was like voiceover and presenting solo. And I, that first graded, I think took me probably an hour to shoot. And it's just like, I think I, the only reason I knew I could do graded was because I got really drunk and did Crown Jewel graded. And I had a lot of fun doing that. I think that was my first graded video. But I basically just got absolutely wankered and poked fun at a show. But yeah, it was sort of weird, very weird. But I'm getting more and more confident, more and more comfortable in front of camera. And hopefully going to move on to some more interesting stuff this year.
What would you tell yourself 2 years ago that you didn't probably know then? What would you advise yourself?
Just keep your head down, keep working. This is it. Just keep going. Like, that's sort of all you can really do. It's like, don't allow yourself to get complacent. Just keep going. Just keep pushing forward. Because if, you know, it works like a well-oiled machine. If I'm not constantly pushing forward, then, you know, it's one cog down. So we need to make sure the machine's always running, make sure that all the parts are okay, make sure that everything's fine, and just keep delivering what people expect of us, and then go above and beyond that. Because I always, like, I've come from a background in production where it's like, you know, you always deliver on time and above expectations. So hopefully that's what we're going to continue to do.
Would you say you're your own worst critic?
Oh yeah, you got to be. It's sort of like, in the nature of post-production, like that whole circle, you pride yourself on your attention to detail. And in a more traditional setting, like when I worked on films and when I worked in corporate media, the editor is invisible. So the whole goal with post-production and editing is for you to not exist, because nobody will ever, unless it's something ridiculous, nobody will ever celebrate an editor. They will always see bad editing, but they will never, like, if you've done your job well enough, they'll never really notice, like, a good editing job. So coming in and having to turn that on its head, because we obviously do the complete opposite, yeah, who's...
Do you feel like that's fair? Do you feel like editors should get more of a...
Of, I think it's the nature of the work. I think it's sort of like, you have pride in what you do and that attention to detail. And like, if you, like, for instance, like if we have like a video come in and there is like something out of place, or there is like the smallest bit of like a mat that's being left or something like that, where it's like I notice it immediately, but then I have to apply that to my own work, because if I'm missing things, then I'm not the best editor I can be. So if I'm going to, you know, go off rhythm, if I'm going to do X, Y, Z, if I'm not going to get everything tight and together, then what's the point? Like, you do something, you do it to the best of your ability, and you should always strive to be the best at what you do. I get that that's sort of not toxic, but it's like, it's a weird way to sort of look at yourself, where it's like, either do the best or just don't bother. But I think it pushes me. I think I'm the sort of person that needs that sort of deliver. Just like, deliver what you want to deliver and do it better than you thought you could. And yeah, there's times where, you know, I've done edits and I'm like, oh, that's terrible. But then you can't beat yourself up too much about it. You've got to sort of... Because at the end of the day, it's a video about wrestling on the internet. It's not like you're, yeah, you're editing Jurassic Park remake or whatever. Like, it's not like this huge era-defining thing, but it's important to somebody out there, and there will always be somebody that picks up on it, and therefore, because it's the new TV, man, like, it's the new TV, you've got to have that standard. Otherwise, if you don't, then it's the Wild West, and people aren't going to expect, you know, X, Y, and Z out of a video, because they don't know if it's going to have this, they don't know if it's going to have that, because it changes so wildly, and it's why we have, like, a set style. But yeah, I think I'm definitely my own worst critic, but... got to be.
Yeah, and also like the pace that we work at as well, there's only, yeah, so much you can allow yourself to do. That what do you do when you're not working and when you're not, and when you're not doing anything to do with wrestling? Did you find that with, because I found that being here, suddenly, yeah, my hobby became my job.
Yeah, so like it's one of those things where I can't go home and watch wrestling to relax, like, or at least normally. So like what I'll do is sometimes I'll get a hankering for like, oh, I'm going to watch WrestleMania 18, and I will do it. But I tend to just, because the I think about it all day, the last thing I want to think about is you know, SmackDown or Raw or whatever, just for a couple of hours. Like, not in a bad way. It's not like I hate wrestling or anything. I love wrestling. It's just that I've done it all day, and I used to not do that. I used to go home and watch wrestling. So now I needed to find something else. I got back into video games. I'm sort of like gently starting to collect video games and consoles and stuff and older stuff like that. It's sort of become a hobby.
You got a Sega Saturn just before Christmas, didn't you?
Yes, so I'm trying to collect every Sega console. So and hopefully get a pretty hefty set of original games in good condition. But yeah, like I don't really do a lot. I've got I've been playing guitar for like 15 years, I think 15, 16 years this year. So I play guitar. I need to get my drum kit set back up. I have a pachinko machine. I watch films like a lot because I recently started like wanting to write again. I've had ideas just floating around for ages that I've just not had time or patience to put down. There's a lot of other stuff I just sort of spitball in my head for new ideas for the channel. Work never really stops, which is the weird thing. It's harder when my living room has like a signed picture of the Great Muta in it as well. I could probably help myself by not having wrestling stuff around, but it's sort of hard. I read comics. I'm trying to just sort of find a new hobby, I think, mainly. Like I'm trying a lot of things out, but I haven't really found one that stuck. But yeah,
do you find it difficult to switch off?
Yeah, like it's all constantly, it's all wrestling. So it's I 9 times out of 10, if I'm not working, I'm sat on like Squared Circle or Twitter or like just looking through random ass old galleries on WWE.com, or like because I find it interesting, or I'm reading about wrestling, or I'm trying to discover something new. Like the wrestling I do watch now when I get in tends to be CMLL, AAA. It's the whole reason I fell in love with Japan, is because like I got to a point where I think it was the first 2 years of me doing this, like in my entire career, I just got burned out. I was like, I can't even think about wrestling. And then it was Wrestle Kingdom 9, and there was such a buzz around it, and I was like, screw it, and put it on. It had English commentary, which was an ordeal, but like it was great, and it was the most accessible Wrestle Kingdom ever. And it blew me away. So having that new thing, because it was so different to WWE, that really made me want to engage with it more. As we've started covering New Japan more, I've sort of cooled down on that a little bit. I'll still put the occasional Saturday morning show on, but I've cooled down on that. I tend to move more toward Mexico. I'm going to try and just balance it in a circle, I think, so I can sort of, through different months, move into different types of wrestling, just to keep it bubbling away. But
so it doesn't become work.
Yeah, so it doesn't become work, but it will eventually become work, because that's the nature of the business. So,
do you try and put stuff in place to help the work-life balance?
In what respect?
In 'cause for like, for me personally, it's learning to leave your phone in the bedroom.
Yeah.
Or it's learning to go somewhere without it altogether.
Yeah.
I don't know whether you try, succeed or fail with stuff like that, because I'm not very good.
I'm sort of really, I have a very, very, very hard time taking work out of my head. Like I can't really do it. It's just sort of, it's the nature of what we do, with it being a company we started. It's always in there. I'm lucky enough to be able to go down country to my girlfriend's and get away from Newcastle, because Newcastle sort of, because it's where my work has always been. I sort of tie the city to just work stresses and stuff, so it's nice to be able to get out. But yeah, I'd sort of, for me, I guess it's a problem, but like it's not at the same time, because it doesn't so much bother me. I'd rather be, you know, sat with my phone next to me and have an alert come through going like, this has happened, and know than get in the next day and be like, I didn't know. And yeah, it's sort of, I'm always thinking about editing. I'm always thinking about ways we can streamline stuff. I'm always thinking about, you know, if the team are okay, what we can do to make things a bit more fun. Like how we're going to utilize new spaces, which, you know, like the studio up here, like we've got these chairs, they might go at some point. What are we going to do like with that? It never turns off. Like it's just always on.
You mentioned your girlfriend downcountry.
Yes.
How did you guys meet?
So we met for the first time at a meet and greet, funnily enough. But then she's a tattoo artist, so I'd seen that she'd done some designs for Triple Jump before, just like did a flash sheet, sort of jokingly. And then I approached her to see if she could design me a t-shirt, and then just sort of took off from there. But, yeah.
Is she a wrestling fan as well?
Yes. Yeah.
So do you find that do you find that you fight it even more so to switch off?
She's more of a video gaming fan than a wrestling fan. Like she doesn't watch weekly shows. She'll watch like the occasional NXT. She'll stay in the loop. She'll, you know, like we watched the Rumble the other night. She'll watch Mania. She's more of a casual wrestling fan, I guess. So it's a lot easier to sort of not talk about it at all. But yeah, that being said, we watch Dark Side of the Ring a lot. We watch like, and you know, there's just like loads of stuff like that. I think when we're in Tokyo in October, we're going to try and check out a Stardom show or a DDT show, maybe Noah if there's something running. But yeah, it's a lot easier because she prefers video games, so we can just talk about that, which is nice.
I'm actually excited for your Tokyo trip. Not because I'm coming with you.
I was going to say.
Not been invited formally.
As much as I love you, this is I need to get away from all of you guys.
And not been invited yet. But because I saw when you guys went to Japan for New Japan.
Yeah.
And what's really obvious in that video is the joy in your eyes when you're there.
Oh, yeah. It feels
like your happy place.
It was like, it was weird. It was just weird, like going somewhere you've never been and then feeling like it's like home. It was really, really strange because I always wanted to go. Like, I've always been a little weeb. So, like, always wanted to go. And then, you know, getting somewhere and having it be everything you thought it was going to be and more. And enjoying it, like we had such a good time. We were lucky enough to meet guys like Tama Tonga, Hanare, other members of the Bullet Club family. And it was just sort of, to have that experience and to be able to share it with like two of my mates, it was the best thing ever. But I think the problem for me there was that Richard stayed an extra week and I was going to, but I just couldn't afford it. And then he came back and he's like, hey, we got so much better. Like, we didn't have to work. And I was like,
you don't want to hear that, do you?
So I was like, well, I need to go back. So planned it and yeah. Missing the G1 final though by a couple of days, but it's fine.
One thing away from wrestling that you're looking forward to doing out there?
I don't know. I really like arcades. I really like sushi. I really like pretty much everything that's going on, but I don't know. I think just mainly just drinking and having a good time. Just getting lost in a new city is always good.
Is there a bar or a pub in your mind?
I always think about the izakaya. Like, so izakaya are like, they're like small post-war bars with like 8-9 stools. That's it. So it's like a bar, stools, and a toilet at the end. And they're all very long and narrow or small and compact. There was one in Golden Guy, which is like an area, like a touristy trap area, that we were in, and they were just playing like old school Pink Floyd and just weird psychedelic stuff. And we were just sat there drinking whiskeys and highballs and beers, and it was just great. So like something like that, again, I'll probably do, just go get a little bit arseholed. But I think mainly I'm looking forward to, you know, going and see some shrines and just wandering around. I think I'm going to try and do Fuji. I don't know. We'll see.
Now, before we get to your final match,
yes,
the other three things that you're allowed to take with you on the island
right,
are a movie,
yeah,
an album,
yeah,
and a luxury item.
Right.
What's your movie?
So, movies.
I know. I'm expecting something by Tarkovsky coming your way.
So, yeah, it's funny you say Tarkovsky. So, I like a broad range of cinema. So I was sort of indoctrinated into like world cinema through film studies. I love the work of Andrei Tarkovsky. I love the work of Jean-Pierre Jeunet. I love the French New Wave. I love the German New Wave, the Italians. Like, it's all great. And then at the same time, I love trash, car crash, blockbusters. And like, I just love everything to do with films. So it's really hard for me to choose one. I think if I was going to choose something, it's sort of a toss-up. You either go for something that's going to make you super happy, something that's going to make you reminisce, or something massively long and complex that you need to watch 1,000 times to get your head around, like Primer. You could pick a film like Stalker by Tarkovsky, which is like nearly 4 hours long, and it's all about like the metaphysical argument and all this crazy stuff. And at the end of all of it, like, there's films like Reservoir Dogs, which I adore, like, but I don't think I could watch it again and again and again. But there's one film that I can go back to every single time, no matter how much I've watched it, and it always makes me happy, and it's Amelie. Amelie is my favorite film in the world, hands down. Everything about it is so well done. Like, the color, everything. Like, Jeunet's amazing. The performances are amazing. And the music is unbelievable. And it's a film that no matter what cheers me up. So I think I'd probably take Amelie. But, yeah.
How about an album?
Again, this is really hard because, like, music was my first love. Like, wrestling didn't really factor until after I started, like, really enjoying music. I always figured I'd end up doing something in music rather than what I do. But it's weird because, like, I'm into really, really heavy stuff, and I'm into really, really weird stuff. And I love, like, stuff like Meshuggah. I like stuff like Strapping Young Lad. I like stuff like Gorgoroth and Dark Throne and Abbath and all these, like, you know, just like weird Scandinavian, like, just heavy. But at the same time, like, I'm a huge fan of Pink Floyd. I'm a huge fan of Rush. I'm a huge fan of Dream Theater. And I like prog. I like all that stuff. And there's probably two albums it would boil down to. One is Dark Side of the Moon, because it's just amazing. And that's really hard because I wanted to pick Animals, but Dark Side of the Moon's got a bit more going on. And then my other favorite bands are Pixies and Nine Inch Nails. I also love Smashing Pumpkins, that whole scene. As much as I love Pixies, I'd probably have to go with Nine Inch Nails. So I think it's a toss-up between, with Nine Inch Nails, The Downward Spiral or The Fragile. But The Downward Spiral is so depressing that you've got to cut it loose. So it's either The Fragile or Dark Side of the Moon. And if I had to pick, it would probably be The Fragile because there's so much more on it. And it's really well structured, and it's not as down. It's quite hopeful in places. It's quite nice in places. It's quite aggressive and horrible in places. It's got like a nice blend of emotion going into the album. So I think I'd go with The Fragile.
Who do you say would you say influenced your music taste?
I grew up in a household with like Iron Maiden, Black Sabbath, Thin Lizzy. But then stuff as weird as like it would go from like that to like ABBA to Boney M to like Bob Marley to just weird like Rick Astley, like. But I think like I used to sit and just stare at vinyls. Like my dad had like a set of vinyls, and I'd just sit and stare at like a copy of Number of the Beast with the really cool artwork and like all the strings being pulled and like just sit and stare at this really ornate, cartoony, violent artwork. And like just get obsessed with it. So I think it was more that, and then like just as I grew, I think I just started getting into angrier and angrier music. I picked up guitar. My guitar teacher was a guy that basically specialized in heavy music, and so that was just sort of bred into me from there. Pantera like was some of the stuff I learned the most, and yeah. And then on top of that, I started listening to Aphex Twin, and I don't know what's going on with my music tastes. I'm sorry.
No, never. You should never say sorry.
Yeah.
Why do you feel you need to say sorry?
I don't feel like I need to say sorry. It's just like, you know, people get very, very protective over, you can only listen to one type of music.
Yeah, they do, don't
especially
they?
Especially in the metal scene where it's like, this isn't true metal.
Do you get that quite a bit then with certain bands you like?
I tend to be like that with some.
Oh, right. Well, it's good then. You can call upon it.
Yeah, I can sit there and be like, this band sucks.
How about a luxury item?
I'd probably take... I have a John 5, former Marilyn Manson, current Rob Zombie guitarist. I have a Signature Series gold top Telecaster of his with Seymour Duncan's and everything in it. And if I could get some indestructible strings and a way for it to make sound, then I'd be taking that.
How did you come across that?
What, the guitar?
Yeah.
I like him.
Was it a purchase you made?
It was a purchase I made. It was one of those things where, like, at my old job, it was like the first year I worked there, I got a bonus and I went to the cinema with my friend and I foolishly told him that I got a bonus and he's the worst influence in the world. and he went, oh, look, let's just go into the guitar shop. You've got a bonus. And I was like, yeah, it's fine. And then walked in and it was just there. And I was like, oh, like, I can't not buy it now. So I had to go and buy it. And it's the greatest guitar I've owned so far in terms of setup. I own like a Les Paul, like a Gibson Les Paul Custom, which is beautiful, great guitar. But I don't know, this Tele's just unbelievable.
What was the first guitar you owned?
I owned an Encore Strat copy. Still own it. It went out of tune all the time. It was almost impossible to play anything meaningful on it. It sounded like tin, just awful. But it was my first guitar, so I'll never sell it on.
And how did you come to own it? Was it bought for you? Did you buy it yourself?
I'd originally started off by learning in school, like we'd learn keyboards and we'd learn Glockenspiel. And then my cousin had a clarinet that was no longer in use, and it was like, do you want to learn clarinet? And it was like, all right. And clarinet and saxophone are very similar, so you can sort of fill in the gaps and sort of learn both at once if you really apply yourself. But I'd always end up giving them up because I was always just like, well, it's boring. Who wants to listen to clarinet? And like, my teacher's teaching us Ode to Joy, and I'm like, I can't be arsed. Like, Ode to Joy, like, it's great, but it's just, it's like, it's boring. And then around that time, I was like, yeah, MTV2 was a thing. And you just see people like Kurt Cobain just trashing equipment, or Sonic Youth just smashing stuff up and using prepared guitars and all this stuff. And it was like cool. It was just effortlessly cool. And then I think it was like, I was 13. I think it was 13. It was either 12 or 13, but at Christmas I was like, I want a guitar. And my parents were like, really? I was like, yeah. And they were like, well, you know, you've given up on X, Y, and Z. I was like, I'm not going to give up on guitar. And they were like, you said that about the other ones. I was like, yeah, but I'm not going to give up on guitar. So they got me a guitar reluctantly, and then I just sort of took it from there. Like, I was really serious about it. Like, sought out a proper teacher and everything, and that was sort of it. It just sort of came to me that way.
It's nice when people watch the news and you bust it out. I'm always impressed at the speed you learn new songs.
It's sort of, as long as it's chords, like, you're fine. Like, yeah. I never play anything properly.
But it's such a skill. Like, I'm pretty tone deaf, and the idea of picking up guitar terrifies me.
Guitar's really easy. Bang. As long as you can keep it in tune, like, it's everybody seems to be really, like, phased by it, and I was... like, it's daunting when you first start because, you know, there's a certain way you hold the pick. But, you know, it doesn't matter if you don't hold it completely correct, because some of the greatest guitarists in history hold their picks really weird. So it's like, you've got to find something that's comfortable for you that fits within the realm of everything else so that you can tune it. And then once you can tune it, you just learn shapes. You just learn positions for your fingers, and that's it. It's like, all you have to do is keep it in tune and keep your left arm and hand, like, dexterous. That's it. Like... it's really, really simple to pick up as long as you're willing to suck ass for about 3 weeks to a month. And then you'll teach yourself something and you'll notice that you can actually pick properly, and it all starts coming in naturally. If you learn, like, really simply, like with things like Rage Against the Machine riffs and like Jericho's board.
Sorry, Jericho.
But you sort of like learn very slowly and you pick things up, and it's super easy. It's just learning shapes.
But it must be a passion thing, because we spoke earlier on and you talked about how, you know, with some line of work, you're either do it great or don't do it.
Yeah.
You know, the ability to push through that suck barrier,
yeah,
to smash guitar shows it's obviously...
it's, well, yeah, within you. I wouldn't say I'm a great player to any degree, but like, I... yeah, you just sort of, if you want something, you've got to go after it, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's get to your third and final match for your DVD, sir.
So we've had two sentimental ones. This one's purely a Sam pick. This one's purely a Sam pick, and it's all mine, and I would literally stand there on this island and watch it on a loop. It is the final meeting, the final singles meeting between Tiger Mask 1, Satoru Sayama, and Dynamite Kid from New Japan Pro Wrestling Big Fight Series on 21st of April, 1983.
Wow. So why that one in particular?
Because it's explosive. So these guys have been having a feud for ages. It's been back and forth. Tiger Mask, I don't know if you've seen Tiger Mask 1 much.
We've had a few people suggest Tiger Mask and Dynamite Kid as their matches, which is testament to...
So Satoru Sayama, the first Tiger Mask, he came to the UK. I think he went to Mexico and the US as well. But he came to the UK and worked World of Sport as Sammy Lee. And he was blending this mixture of styles, like British, American, and almost martial arts style, to the point where he was lightning fast, and it was amazing. So they gave him the whole gimmick with Tiger Mask. They did the tie-in, and he just became like a superhero. And then you had Dynamite Kid, who was just a contemptible little evil, like even in real life. But the thing with Dynamite was that he was just so good. Like, you can't look at his matches and be like, they're bad. Like, he's just 110% at all times. Otherwise, what's the point? It's sort of like that. But when you watch this match, they are 30 years ahead of their time. Like, they're hitting suicide dives. There's package pile drivers to the outside. There's a double count out halfway through the match. And it's like, what's going on? And the crowd don't, like, Dynamite's not having it, so he continues. Referee's trying to stop. And then Tiger Mask's like, no, I'm okay. Ref restarts the match. Crowd goes ape. Like, wow. And it goes, and then it ends in a double count out. And it's like, what? And then it's just properly high energy back and forth. Like, you could put that on any indie card in the world today, and it would blow everything else on the card out of the water. Like, it's amazing. Utterly, utterly amazing. It's just excitement. Like, I think the open and exchange is sort of they pace around a little bit. Dynamite goes sprinting at Tiger Mask. Tiger Mask just sort of goes up and over his back like it's nothing, and then just locks him straight up, and it's like just mental.
Which two wrestlers in 2020 do you feel could assemble a match on that level?
Osprey and I'm trying to think, because
we're not short of incredibly talented performers in the ring. Not that we were then, but...
I'm just trying to think of more like a direct specialist. I think if you took somebody like Osprey and... I mean, if you keep with New Japan, you could probably use Ibushi. Or if you wanted to go real weird, like Osprey versus somebody like Chad Gable with a firm wrestling background, like then you might get that sort of contrast, because Dynamite was like so World of Sport, tie everybody in knots, but at the same time violently explosive. And then Tiger Mask knew everything, but was more of a like crazy high flyer. But Osprey's a shout for whoever his opponent would be. Like, he's probably the only guy I think that would be able to capture that energy and utilize it.
Would you say Osprey's one of your favorites?
Oh, 100%. He's one of the nicest guys in the world. He is just like straightforward, one of the best wrestlers alive, like probably in history. So that's it.
Before we go, I want you to tell your story about JR. This is the one that now this is a story that me and Sam have spoke about off camera.
It's been on, well, I mentioned it on the WCPW podcast as
did
well.
Did you talk about it there as well? Yeah. Well, I'd quite like to hear it again.
Okay.
Because I think it's a nice way to end it on.
On the day of our first iPay-per-view, way back at the old place. I was pooing myself horribly. Like, it was, I didn't think I was ready. I didn't think I was anywhere near qualified for the situation. I thought it was going to explode. I didn't think everything would be ready on time. Like, it was approaching the hour that everything was going to go live. And then Jim Cornette showed up, and he was really cordial. JR showed up, and I sort of froze, because it's weird, because JR's voice is just his voice. Like, he doesn't put on an announcing voice. That's his voice. So it's like the voice of your childhood. And he's just sort of like, you know, talking to you. But he's being quite, like, work-based. So it's like, what's happening? Where's the shooting schedule? And it's like, And then we had like a meeting where we went through everything and we made sure that they had all their notes and we made sure that they, like, if they needed any water or energy drinks or anything like that, it would be there for them. And we just did sort of a dry run through the order of the night. And Cornette got changed, left, everybody else left. And I was sort of in there, JR's like on his phone. And I was just sort of like just sort of stood there. And he was like, "What's wrong?" I was like,
"So this is JR saying what's wrong?"
And he was like, "You look nervous." So I was like, "Yeah." And he was like, "Why are you nervous?" I was like, "I've never done this before." He's like, "First time." I was like, "Yeah." He's like, "What do you do?" I was like, "I do all the camera selection, like live direction, vision mixing." And he was like, "Well, do you like sport?" I was like, "Yeah." He's like, "Do you like football, like American football?" I was like, "Yeah." He asked me who I supported and told him. And then we had like a little conversation. And then he said, "The thing is, like, you don't want to shoot it like everybody else is shooting it these days. Like, it's so convoluted." He's like, "Just show the action. Just like football doesn't have crash zones when somebody gets hit. It's like, it just shows the action. Just show the action. And nobody can accuse you of like not doing your job to the best of your ability. It's like, you just make sure you've always got coverage and just show whatever you can." And I started to like calm down. And then he sort of reached over to grab his hat and he just went, "At the end of the day, just get out there." And he put his hat on and then just like went on my back and was like, "And hit all the buttons, baby." And then fixed his hat and walked out. And I was like, just went out, smashed it, and then the server crashed, so nobody saw the paper.
Away from that sad bit, I love the JR pep talk story.
I was meant to. It's like, my favorite bit is that, and like, I knew he wasn't ever going to remember me because it's like, you know, it's Jim Ross. He meets 1,000 people a day, and why would he remember me? And we're at an Inside the Ropes talk with JR in Newcastle. And I go up to him, meet him afterwards, and I knew it was coming. He went, "Nice to meet you, son. I'm Jim Ross." Oh. I was like, "Yeah, that was great. That was like perfect." Oh, no. It made it like better for me because I was like, it's just perfect. He just goes around giving pearls of wisdom to people all the time. Like, there wasn't anything significant in that. He just sort of showed me, "You can do it. Just chill the F out. Like, you'd be fine."
Well, as one of the guys who very much is among our great team, sort of behind the scenes directing some of the amazing videos that you see. I know it was your brainchild, the Keith video.
Yes.
And I always want to make sure. Yeah. I think I speak on behalf of everybody who sat out there. We're very glad you're pressing the buttons, baby.
Oh, thank you.
And thank you for joining me on Cultaholic Island.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
For all the wrestling headlines in just 10 minutes, search Cultaholic Wrestling News on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.